Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's an old saying that you can't really understand someone else until you've walked a mile in his shoes. But what if that someone else is a migrating bird, and that mile you need to travel was actually hundreds of miles? Daunting factors for sure, but not enough to deter one of our guests today, who wanted to better understand what hawks experience on their annual winter journey south. So last year, he got on his bicycle and followed the broadwing hawk's migration from New Hampshire to South America. Today in The Exchange, what he learned from this epic trip, also what remains a mystery about hawk migration. We'll also find out where hawks and other raptors go, how they get there, and the factors that get in their way. Let's hear from you, too, your stories, questions, comments about raptor migration. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With me in studio, Julie Brown, monitoring site coordinator for the Hawk Migration Association of North America. Julie, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Phil Brown, Director of Land Management for New Hampshire Audubon. Phil is also the site coordinator for the Pacmanadnock Raptor Migration Observatory. That's an Audubon project. And Phil, good to have you too. Thank you.
It's good to be here.
And also with us, Eric Masterson, Land Protection Specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education, author of Birdwatching New Hampshire. And last fall, Eric followed the broadwing hawk's migratory route, as I said, on his bike from New Hampshire to South America. And Eric, wow. Great trip, and we'll hear about it, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, just to talk a little bit about this trip, why did you decide to do this?
Well, sometimes my wife asks me that question, and sometimes I ask myself. My contention is that hawk migration is one of the great natural wonders of the world and somewhat underappreciated. We've all heard of the Great Barrier Reef. I would guess if you went to Australia and asked people about hawk migration in North America, they probably wouldn't have a clue what you were talking about, and I think that I would love to be able to change that. So in 2015, I got on a plane to fly south to Kekkeldy, which is where Julie spent a couple of seasons. It's one of the world's top raptor migration sites, and we'll talk more about
where it. Where is it?
It's in Costa Rica.
Okay.
And so I was flying down there from New Hampshire. I got on the plane in Manchester. And, you know, I'd spent time at Pacmanadnock in Peterborough, and I was heading down to where these birds would wind up in about 2 months' time, a month and a half's time. And as I was flying over the Appalachians, I realized that I was missing the story. I was going from one endpoint to another endpoint, and I was missing the real story, which is playing out underneath 30,000 feet below the plane over the course of several months. And I vowed to do something about that. And so I was going to do it on a motorbike just for logistical reasons. And then I thought about the hawks, and it's just the hawks, the earth, and the sun, and it's elemental. And so I thought I needed to get as close to that. And at the time, I thought the closest I could get would be the hawks won't cross water for reasons we'll discuss later. They need thermal updrafts to stay aloft. So they'll cross over land. So I can cross land. I don't have to cross water, but I can't fly. So I best thing I can do to strip it down to bare essentials is to go on a bicycle. And so that was the genesis of it.
And you wanted to work for it like the hawks did. So that's why you didn't choose the motorbike.
Yeah. It's literally the hawk, the earth, and the sun. And those three fundamentals come together, and they use the ridge lines for lift and the sun's heat to generate thermals. And so I just wanted to get back to basics.
So the broadwing hawk is the one that you followed.
Right.
So that one in particular migrates only over land, or do all hawks migrate over land?
No, some birds that, so flapping flight is powered flight. And so you can power yourself through adverse conditions. So if there's no thermal updraft, if there's headwinds, you can power yourself. So a falcon is uses powered flight a lot. A budio is a family of birds that includes the broad-winged hawk and the red-tailed hawk. And their preferred mode of travel is to just hold their wings out straight and soar. And they catch thermals. They don't have to flap. And they save an awful lot of, it's like driving a Prius versus driving a gas hog. They save an awful lot of energy just by using the sun's input rather than their own muscle energy.
Just by coasting. Well, yeah. Since you followed the broadwing hawk in particular, Eric, let's just play for our listeners a little bit of what a broadwing hawk sounds like. This is from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology website, All About Birds. Let's hear a little. Okay, so it sounds like a cute little bird. It doesn't sound like a ferocious raptor predator. What does it look like, Eric?
So they're about the size of a crow. So they're a relatively small hawk. And they've got brownish upper parts, white belly, breast, very variably streaked with brown. And then they have the distinctive field mark for these birds is, visual field mark is that they have a banded black and white tail, but dark brown and white bands on the tail. Another field mark is that in the fall, they travel in these enormous flocks. And
wow.
So they're not great to look at. I mean, they're not incredibly pretty. Their sound is pretty plaintive, but they have this incredible, their field mark, just like a thrush's field mark is its sound, their field mark is this incredible journey they take every year.
We'll hear more about that journey in just a moment. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us as well as we talk about the raptor migration that we see every fall from New Hampshire to points south. 1-800-892-6477. If you want to give us a call, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I also want to encourage you to check out our Facebook page, especially today. Our guests, our producer Jessica Hunt, and our listeners have put up some really cool raptor photos. It's NHPR Exchange on Facebook. You can look at it. You can put your own photos there, so check it out. So, Julie, let's just get a couple definitions out of the way. What's a hawk and what's a raptor?
Well, people often use the two terms in the same way. Hawks are raptors. Raptors are birds of prey. They have sharp talons. They have a sharp beak. And they could be owls. They could be hawks. Falcons. So when we're talking about hawks, there are true hawks. So there are broadwing hawks, red-shouldered hawks, Cooper's hawk, species like that. And then there are kites. There are eagles. Osprey is kind of in its own family. And then the falcons. So when we can just refer to them all as raptors, but sometimes we lump them together as hawks.
So raptor is basically a hunting bird.
Yes.
They eat lizards, they eat insects, they eat mice, and so on. Yeah.
Yep.
What distinguishes them in the air? There's so many times where I look up and I go, I think that's some kind of raptor. I'm not really sure what kind, but I can tell it's a raptor.
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes some training and some practice to figure out different hawks. Usually raptors have streaked brown and white on their body, although you can't always go by color when you're hawk watching. You kind of have to throw color out the window and go by overall shape and how they're flying, how they're flapping. But usually, they display all kinds of different flight behavior. Sometimes they can be tucked up or soaring like a broadwing, like Eric mentioned. They can be using powered flight. So it just takes a little bit of practice to learn the different field marks.
And Phil, what kinds of raptors and hawks, as we're learning, are especially prominent here in New Hampshire? Which ones do we see a lot?
Well, as Eric mentioned, the broad-winged hawk is probably the most numerous in migration. We see about 75% of our total fall count consists of broad-winged hawks. They're very common in the summer, but we also see a lot of red-tailed hawks, bald eagles, more and more. We saw one this morning on the drive into the studio, in fact.
Really?
Yeah, so they're becoming a pretty common sighting now. They're also the smaller excipiters, the sharp-shinned hawk, and Cooper's hawks, which are adapting to city life pretty well, eating a variety of urban birds like pigeons and starlings.
Which ones seem to be doing especially well here in New Hampshire?
Well, it's a big question. So unpacking that a little bit, I guess, we have to look at regional trends. But in New Hampshire itself, we have a list of species that is either endangered, threatened, or of special concern. And there are several raptors on those lists. So probably top of that list, as far as that category goes, northern harriers are very uncommon overall. But what's doing especially well? I'd say broad-winged hawks, plenty of those in the summertime. Lots of red-tailed hawks as well.
And as you said, eagles are getting more plentiful.
Yes.
And I remember we did a show this summer on loons, and anybody can jump in on this. And one of the comments that we got from several listeners was concern that the increased health of the eagle population was hurting the loon population. Have we seen that among raptors? The rise of the eagle has been bad news for other raptors, Phil?
That is definitely starting to play out in some ways. More study needs to be done, but anecdotal observations are showing that bald eagles are displacing ospreys at traditional nesting sites in New Hampshire. So ospreys may be forced to some of the more marginal breeding sites, and that may be part of the long-term declines that we're seeing in ospreys in the Northeast.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. As we look at raptor migration, a fall ritual for many Granite Staters, trying to spot hawks and other raptors overhead and identify them as they make their way to warmer climates. We'd love to get your questions and comments in at 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, let's talk about migration. And when you think about it, it really is kind of a miracle in a way. And Eric, to you first, you said that you hope your trip will elevate hawk migration as one of the great natural wonders of the world. What's the wonder about it for you?
Well, I mean, I'm just spellbound by it. I take hundreds of hours of recordings of nocturnal migrations. I have a parabolic reflector and a mic, and I put it up my yard and I record hundreds of hours every year of nocturnal migrants. But you can't see them. They pass in the dead of night. There are other migrants that pass over the ocean, far out of sight of land. You can't see those either. And so most migration, it is a truly stunning phenomenon, but we just don't get to see it. And with a very few exceptions, and diurnal hawks that migrate during the day, are one of those exceptions.
Oh, so that was another reason why you chose broadwings.
Oh, yeah.
They migrate over land,
yeah.
And they migrate during the day. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I chose them for several reasons. One, they migrate over land. They migrate during the day. And it's kind of I'm using this story, and I'm working on a book. I'm using this story as a larger story about migration in general, but also the Northeast broadwing hawks. I mean, you could in a fall in eastern North America see a broadwing hawk migrating overland, you know, pretty much anywhere in eastern North America. But they do seem to follow these leading lines, and the Appalachian seems to be an actual metaphorical highway. It's like a 3,000 foot high road in the sky that you can't see. And they all pile. If you imagine we all emptied out as people, if we all emptied out of the U.S. into South America, what would happen if we all got onto one road? And as the farther down the road we get, this mythical highway in the sky, the traffic gets worse and worse and worse.
Like
and
going to Cape Cod on, you know, Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or Loudoun for the races. And so in New Hampshire on a big day, you might see 1,000, 2,000 broad-winged hawks, which is, if anyone hasn't been up to Pachmannock during mid-September during these conditions to see it, it's a phenomenal thing. But just to realize 1,000 becomes, when it gets down to the mid, you know, the mid-Atlantic states, and then on into Texas, the snowball effect. In a big day in Texas, you could be talking about several hundred up to, high hundreds of thousands of broadwinged hawks in
a
single day.
And then by the time you get down to Central America, where the landmass gets really skinny,
yeah.
What happens?
So the landmass gets skinny, and in Veracruz is probably the place most people may have heard about. In Veracruz, the landmass is skinny, and the mountains actually come out to the coast and further pinch the birds. And so they can have counts of up to 1 million birds in a day down there.
And they're following the mountains, Julie, because, just remind us.
Yeah, well, it's a visual landmark that's kind of guiding them south, any north to south running ridgeline, which makes Pachmannock such a good hawk watch. They're also using coastlines, river valleys like the Mississippi, any north to south running rivers in New Hampshire. is a visual landmark for them, and they're also able to conserve energy because they're using those updrafts off the ridge lines.
That's that smart method of travel that they have that Eric described earlier. Phil, I love your thoughts too. Again, using the mountains partly for that visual recognition that you described, but partly because that's where the warm air comes up and they can just coast on it?
Well, the prevailing winds from the north and the west in the fall especially are creating these updrafts on the ridge lines that are running northeast to southwest generally. And a lot of the hilltops in general in New Hampshire have that same effect. So the ridge lines are especially great places, but any little bump in the landscape could be an effective place to watch hawks. So we've picked a couple that have been traditionally excellent places to view the migration.
Have you ever seen that phenomenon that Eric described down in Central America where it's,
I
said, the highway to Cape Cod? Yeah, go ahead.
I was lucky enough to go last fall leading a Hamana tour, and we got to see several hundred thousand broad-winged hawks, turkey vultures, and Swainson's hawks in a matter of a couple of days. And it's just phenomenal. You stop counting and you just appreciate the spectacle and just awe at it.
Does the sky get dark? I mean, with all that many, I'm thinking of Alfred Hitchcock, you know, and I know that's not a nice analogy,
not exactly from what I saw, but maybe Julie has seen bigger days even.
Sure. Yeah, I was lucky enough to work a couple seasons in Costa Rica at Keckle D, what Eric mentioned, which is one of the world's greatest spots for seeing migration. The hawks are, you know, they're being funneled through Central America, and they're squeezed between the Talamancan Mountains and the coastline, and you can see, you know, a few hundred thousand birds or more in a day. And it was my job to count them, which is, it can be difficult.
That sounds impossible, actually.
Luckily, I'm not by myself. You need a whole team of people to do it. You need clickers to click and kind of estimate in tens and twenties at times. And sometimes you have to divide up the sky so that, you know, different people can watch different flight lines, because you might have hundreds of thousands of birds over the ocean, some in front of you, some over all different species. So your team of counters will need to know their raptor ID first and then be able to count and estimate. And it's amazing how good you can get at estimating these numbers. I've trained a lot of people in hawk watching in counting these big groups, and after a group of birds that may be 10,000, we've all six or seven people have come within 100 birds of each other. So it's actually pretty effective estimating numbers once you figure out the right way to do it. And the way you go about it, when they're swirling around in what we call a kettle, which is a raptor term of birds rising in a thermal, it's absolute chaos. You couldn't count it when they're swirling around. But once they reach the top of a thermal, they'll kind of just glide out single file, more or less. And that's the best time to count them.
It sounds like a mess, but it sounds like you've made a way to work to make it work.
Yeah, exactly. We have a whole standardized protocol that Hamana created, and we make that available to sites. There are over 200 migration monitoring sites, just like the two or few here in New Hampshire, and they're all submitting their fall and spring migration data to Hamana's database, hawkcount.org. So it's pretty amazing what's happening and how we're able to collect all this useful information.
Well, after a break, we'll go to our listeners. Got a couple of people who have questions. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, too, with your questions, comments, your own observations about hawk and other raptor migration. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. And check out our Facebook page today. There's some nice photos there put up by our guests, our producer Jessica Hunt, and our listeners. Some photos of raptors. So check those out. NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing, but it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, raptor migration. That's a red-tailed hawk sound courtesy of Cornell University. Here in New Hampshire, it's a rite of fall to try and spot one of the many birds making their annual trip from New England to Point South. This hour, we're focusing on hawks and other raptors, and let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, observations are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Eric, Julie, and Phil, let's go to our listeners now. And Ian joins us from Chichester. Hi, Ian. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi. I just wanted to make one observation about the wonders of migration. I have a question about nighthawks. But my observation about the wonders of migration is I do barn preservation in the state. And in the fall, every year, you know, the barn swallows, they're there one day, and then they're gone the next. And they, I think they migrate down to, the, like, Argentina. And, you know, the wonder of the trip they take every year is just amazing. My question about nighthawks is that I saw in the fall once a flock of, it must have been at least 100 nighthawks. And I know that they're buggies. I don't know if they're really raptors or not. But I wanted to know how common that was and where they go in the wintertime.
Okay, Ian, thank you so much. And Phil, go ahead.
Okay, well, yeah, nighthawks, not true hawks, in fact, but they look an awful lot like some of our raptors that are flying by. They have a falcon shape, generally long, pointed wings, and they tend to all leave in large numbers, just like the broad-winged hawks. And they're following an insect food source, so the insects start to run out in late summer. The nighthawks all have to vacate the northern forests where they breed. They're called the common nighthawk, but they're actually not very common. They are now a state-listed species in New Hampshire, and they're even on a threatened list in Canada. So they're really limited, and they're heading pretty far south. And maybe Eric knows a little bit more about locations.
Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I loved Ian's comment about the barn swallow, because that is how most people witness migration. They get up one day and the bird is gone, or they get up in the spring and it's there. And it's just, for me, it's wonderful. And kudos, Ian, for keeping those barns there for the swallows. They need them.
Go ahead, Julie.
I was just going to say, it's amazing to see those common nighthawks in New Hampshire. It's one of those phenomenons we see every year. And those numbers just grow as they're heading south. They're heading all the way to South America. And then when I worked in counting hawks in Costa Rica, we would see groups of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 nighthawks. So it's not just the hawks that we're watching. It's a whole host of, you know, butterflies and dragonflies and other passerines and bird species that make it so exciting.
Well, and Ian said he appreciated Eric's description, the wonder of migration. Eric said, again, it should be one of the great natural wonders of the world. Everybody should know about it. What are your thoughts about that? What is the wonder or the mystique of this for you?
It really is. It's so exciting to just witness it. These birds are just hardwired to migrate. Often the juvenile birds that were born that summer are the first ones to leave. They're not following their parents south. They just know to go, and they're knowing where to go, you know. And then they have to figure out how to find food. That whole first year of life, it's just so exciting to look up it as a hawk watcher, as someone who's spent a lot of time on ridgelines and coastlines just staring at the sky. You never really know what you're going to see. It's a great mystery and so exciting for me in particular, boreal and Arctic species that may not see people that often coming through. You get these rare glimpses of rough-legged hawks or a group of snow buntings from the Arctic. It's just really exciting.
It is really cool the way they're hardwired, Phil. I like the way that Julie put it. And I've always sort of marveled at that, too. You know, how do they know when to go, where to go? and how to get there.
Yeah, seemingly they just pick up and leave, but there's more to it than that. And I think some of the mystery, if I could speak to that point, is and the magic of it, is that they can do things that we can't, and they represent a sense of freedom that I think we as humans like to think that we have, but they truly embody that ability to leave and migrate. But certain species, depending on what they are triggered by different cues. So it could be daylight for birds like the broad-winged hawk, could be running out of a food source. And many of our later season migrants that we're seeing now into November at the hawk watches are leaving, they're more facultative migrants. So they're leaving when the conditions are just right for migration. So they might just be running out of food, the cold weather might be ushering them out. So it's a number of factors like that.
How has climate change affected migratory patterns? And anybody can jump in on this. If it's triggered by daylight, then, you know, that's not changing. And, you know, days always get shorter and then longer again. But it has been, up until a couple days ago, a very warm fall. We've also had some pretty dramatic weather recently. So I wonder if we know how climate change is affecting hawk migration. Anybody? Phil?
I can jump in. Yeah, a couple of different factors. I guess thinking about storms, dramatic storm events that might be occurring, like Hurricane Maria in the Caribbean, ospreys are flying directly into that. We actually lost some ospreys that were tracked this year. There's a project called Project Osprey that is facilitated by the Squam Lakes Natural Science Center. And they have transmitters. They have satellite transmitters put on the backs of ospreys. So they're recording where they are instantaneously. And some of these ospreys were lost in storms this fall. So they're flying right into storms like that. But I guess more immediately around here, we are seeing, because of the warmer fall, that some species may delay their migrations and not leave in the time frame that we're observing.
Julie?
Yeah, we have, when you look at hawk migration, you have complete migrants like the broad-winged hawk that totally vacates the nesting grounds and heads to South America. Also, you could say ospreys, peregrines too. There are other species that are kind of short-distance migrants that may be more flexible in their migration. So they may be responding more to local weather or climate changes, like the red-tailed hawk. We're seeing some declines in red tails in the east from some of the migration data from our database. And that may not necessarily mean that populations are declining. It could be that this is just a species responding to, you know, maybe milder winters, so it's not migrating as far, or changing its migration behavior and migrating a different way. So, yeah.
What else, Eric, tends to get in the way of raptor migration?
Well, I think we kind of nailed the main causes. The weather is a key one. Phil alluded to that. And the North Atlantic Oscillation, the system that draws wind west across the Atlantic from the North American continent to Europe, depending on how high that index is, how strong that is, that can affect where and when these birds move. And just to go back to, and not hawks, but climate change and how it's affecting migrants, there is some studies now to link a disconnect between an insectivorous, like a warbler or a thrush, arriving on its breeding grounds, which over millennia would have been timed to coincide with the hatch of insects. And there's now a decoupling of that as insects hatch earlier because they're responding to local conditions.
I see.
These birds are, as people have mentioned, are hardwired.
I see. So these birds are hardwired to leave at X date.
Yeah.
And they've done so for forever because the insects down in wherever they go hatch around a certain time, but if that hatching happens earlier, they get there and they say, "Hey, we're hungry," and there's nothing to eat.
Yeah, and everything's part of the same system, so there's a trophic effect.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, and check out the pictures too today on our Facebook page. Let's go to Susan in Goffstown. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just have a comment about a we thought was a red-tailed hawk a couple summers ago. I'm a volunteer at Live and Let Live Farm in Chichester, and a hawk appeared to take care of a rat infestation that we had that year. He would fly down right in front of us, grab a rat, and sit and take care of it right in front of us. And he did that all summer, completely wiped out the rat infestation. We even gave him his own name and his own volunteer number. We were so happy with him.
So did he grab it and sit on the ground and eat it, or did he grab it and, like, take it somewhere and eat it?
Well, sometimes he would take it, and other times, I mean, we would be walking, and he would come right in front of us and grab one that was in the grass that we didn't see, and then just sit on it there and give us a look like, I'm a volunteer. This is my job. Why are you staring at me?
And now you have to tell me what his name was.
We named him Talon.
Okay. Susan, thank you. It's a great story. You know, I never thought of hawks as helping get rid of rodents. I thought that was why people had barn cats, but there you go. All right. Thank you for the call, Susan. Here's an email from Kurt in Hanover, who says, I frequently see a raptor in the sky that I've heard referred to as a turkey vulture or buzzard. I don't believe that it is a hawk. What is the formal name of this bird, and what type of raptor is it? It's a good question, Kurt, because it doesn't seem like we have vultures in New Hampshire, but I guess we do. Phil?
We sure do. Turkey vultures are becoming increasingly common in the Northeast, and that trend has played out over several decades, from when they were first found nesting in the late 70s in New Hampshire, but now they've spread way up into southern Canada. And we're seeing record numbers of them this year. The Carter Hill Raptor Observatory has tallied 417 so far this fall in migration. And you'll regularly see these groups of turkey vultures throughout the summer months, especially sometimes as in a large cluster up to about 100 birds in New Hampshire.
Do we know what's behind that increase, by the way, Phil?
Probably the expansion of highways, more food availability in the north. They are roadkill eaters, and probably various piles of meat that sustain them through the winter.
That's interesting. I would not have thought about that, because when you think about roads being built, you think of, you know, you think habitat destruction, and that's naturally going to hurt wildlife. I mean, that would be what you would think. But in this instance, if they're vultures,
yeah, typically,
they like roadkill.
I think typically that is one of the concerns for conservation of a lot of species is because of the roads and development. But turkey vultures have benefited.
Interesting. Eric, go ahead.
And unlike hawks, they can't grasp with, they don't have talons like hawks or eagles or buteos. And so that's one of the distinguishing features of vultures, and why they can't take live prey, so they focus on carrion. And the ecosystem service that our earlier caller mentioned with the rats and the red-tailed hawk, they provide a huge ecosystem service. And when you get down into Central America and South America, there's another species of vulture called black vulture that is rare in New Hampshire. It's expanding its range northward. But they take, you know, I mean, the service, literally the service they provide in disposing of dead carcasses is incalculable.
So thank you to the hawk that takes away the rats, and thank you to the vultures who take away the junk on the road. Did you want to jump in, Julie?
Sure. Just to add, so that's correct. Turkey vultures aren't true raptors, but they get kind of lumped in with that, and we monitor them at hawkwatch sites because they migrate in the same kind of ways, and they'll use kettles and migrate during the day with other hawks.
But they're not officially raptors because they don't officially hunt. They eat stuff
right,
that's already
they
dead.
They eat carrion, right?
Okay.
Yep.
Well, and speaking of that call from Susan, who got some help from the hawk cleaning the rats out, here's another email. This is Jane in Bedford, who says she lives on a wooded lot and had a nesting pair of hawks behind our home this summer. Using an audio download, I was able to identify them as broadwing hawks. They were very active for several weeks with constant calling back and forth. What we most appreciated was that while we are usually overrun with chipmunks living in the stone walls around our patio, for weeks all the chipmunks disappeared. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Hawk, Jane says. Hope you come back next year. Jane, thank you for the email. Go ahead, Eric.
And beware of the blue jay, because the blue jay is a fantastic mimic of broad-winged hawks. And so if you hear a broad-winged hawk after October 1 or before April 1, suspect the blue jay.
You know, we talked earlier about observing hawks, counting raptors, and Julie told us some amazing stories of her time in Central America and South America watching these huge, huge masses of birds. Eric, on your trip, again, on your bicycle, tracking the Broadwing Hawk, you followed three hawks, right? In particular, they were, do they have little GPS bands on their legs, or how did that work?
Yeah, so I was working with Hawk the Hawk Mountain Research Association down in Pennsylvania, and they're a 100-year-old association that focuses on researching migratory raptors. And they had fitted, they've fitted 13 hawks over since 2014, I believe. They've fitted 13 broad-winged hawks nesting in the Northeast with transmitters. And the technology, transmitter technology has improved dramatically in recent years. The size and the weight has come down, which is very important for migratory species. They can't generally carry more than 3% of their body weight. So these transmitters would drop a point every day, and I was very fortunate to be able to work with Hawk Mountain, and they were sharing their data with me. So I was trying as far as possible. Everything is more difficult on a bike, but I was trying as far as possible to follow the route that these four birds were following, and especially a couple of them I followed more closely. They all pretty much followed the Appalachian route, the Appalachians down to Alabama, to the Gulf Coast, and then they hugged the Gulf Coast pretty closely all the way down into South America. And where I could, if I got a point that was dropped during roosting hours, I would try and visit that location to see where the bird spent the night, and had cause on a few occasions to knock at someone's door and say, "Hi, this is who I am. Did you know a bird slept in your yard about 2 months ago? I was wearing a little backpack." And people were really interested to hear the story.
Well, and by the way, we talked earlier about how the broadwing hawk chooses to migrate over mountains because of the thermals and because it's a marker for them to look at. Yeah. Does that mean you had to bike, you know, mostly through mountains?
Well, yeah. I mean, the mountains don't provide the thermals as much as they provide the ridge lift. And then when they hit, actually, the broadwings really put on the afterburners when they hit the Gulf states, because the thermal generation down in Texas is world-renowned. And so they can get great height. It's essentially, if you can imagine if you can imagine a bunch of people in the Empire State Building, how do you get to the top of the Empire State? You all crowd into the elevator. Well, it's the same with broadwinged hawks. All the broadwinged hawks crowd into these thermals to get to the top. And that they're solitary animals, but because they use this method to get airborne, they form these huge kettles. And those kettles, those thermals in Texas rise to 15, 20,000 feet. And that's when you're gliding from a 20,000 foot perch, you can get a lot farther. And so they're making much greater distance when they get down to the Gulf states.
How hard was it for you to go on your bicycle exactly with these migrating birds? I mean, I'm guessing sometimes there weren't roads where they were going, or there were roads, but it was, you know, a pretty big highway. You don't want to ride your bicycle on that. Or it's in a mountain and it's a really big mountain and you just don't want to bike all the way to the top and then down again.
Well, I did. I lost 35 pounds. That'll tell you something right there. And I climbed in Guatemala. I got to 10,000 feet over a couple of days, which was really tough. So, I tried to where possible, but I have a second phase of the project which is going to enable me to do a better job at that. But I try where possible. I was restricted by road. I used Google Maps, which was a help for most of the trip. Was a help. It got me as close as I could to the route they were taking, using the roadways network.
So you looked at the official maps of where these broadwing hawks migrate, and then you, as closely as possible, approximated that with the help of Google Maps.
Yeah.
All right. We'll find out more after a short break. And keep taking your calls, questions, and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, raptor migration, where they go, how they get there, also what tends to get in their way. Plus, we're hearing a little bit about one granite stater who bicycled the entire route of the broadwing hawk's migration all the way from New Hampshire to Bogota, Colombia. Let's get your questions in, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Eric Masterson is here, land protection specialist with the Harris Center. Last fall, it was Eric who followed the Broadwing Hawk's migratory route on his bike from New Hampshire to South America. Julie Brown's here, monitoring site coordinator for the Hawk Migration Association of North America. And Phil Brown, director of land management for New Hampshire Audubon. Phil is also the site coordinator for the Pakmanadnock Raptor Migration Observatory. Here's an email, actually, about that that observatory, Phil. So I'll throw this to you. Cynthia in Temple says, the migration count sites are wonderful for visitors. Audubon has counters there each day in the fall, and anyone can visit and try binoculars and see for themselves. Cynthia says, it's really fun. I have learned a ton from your guests by visiting myself. Cynthia, thank you for the email. And go ahead, Phil.
Sure. And Pakmanadnock, I should mention, is one of two raptor observatories that New Hampshire Audubon operates. And it's a dual purpose of operating these observatories. The other one is the Carter Hill Observatory in Concord at the Carter Hill Orchard. And it's a perfect blend of environmental education and wildlife research that anybody can do. So, but we do hire a staff person. We have a 5-day-a-week staff person, and we have volunteers who help in fill in the other gaps. But we have full coverage between September 1st and November 20th each year. So there are still, right now, as of today, there are two people at least out there counting migration right at this very moment.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. So September 1st to November 20th, I didn't realize, Phil, that it was that late.
We have extended the season by 5 days, trying to capture more of the migratory period, as we have seen later and later fall onset. So we're trying to make sure that we're gauging the populations effectively.
Do we know, Julie, the birds that you all are observing and counting, do we know if they live the summer in New Hampshire and then they head south, or are they coming from further north, you know, Canada or northern Maine?
Yeah, both, really. We can see raptors here, some species all year round. We'll see red tails and bald eagles. We'll see Cooper's hawks and sharpshins here in the dead of winter. Those could be birds from further north, or they could be birds that just weren't, didn't migrate.
And Eric wrote that on his trip, you know, he said he fully expected to make it back from South America to New Hampshire. But he said that there's a 50% chance a migrating broadwing hawk won't make it back. All of you, but you first, Julie, why such poor odds?
Well, young hawks, they have a lot of challenges in their first year. They're not learning from their parents. You know, they kind of fledge the nest after a few weeks, and they're on their own. They're not really learning how to hunt from their parents. They have to figure that out. They have to deal with a lot of challenges on migration. Finding enough food is really hard. They're essentially starving the whole first year of life. So that's part of the reason we see so many birds migrating at fall sites across the continent, heading south, and then in the spring, the numbers can be much lower because there's such a high mortality in the first year.
Wow, they're starving as they make their way?
Yep, it's hard work learning how to hunt. Go ahead, Phil.
Go ahead, Phil, and then Eric, you too, yeah.
And because they are young birds, they often lack the experience that the adults have in finding the choice and defending their wintering grounds. So sometimes the young birds are found further north, maybe in an area that gets too cold weather to feed effectively. For example, with around here, it would be red-tailed hawks mostly that are juvenile red-tailed hawks in the wintertime. So they're kind of bumped to the less choice territories.
Hmm. Go ahead, Eric.
And for broadwing hawks, they're sit and wait predators, so their preferred mate. They don't catch on the wing like a peregrine or a sharp-shinned hawk. So they'll sit on a branch and wait for something to appear. And when they're traveling from here to Colombia or Brazil, they don't have a lot of time to hunt. And so they don't need as much energy because of the strategy they've employed. But they also don't have a lot of time. And so there is a lot of mortality, especially for young birds.
Because they're just not eating enough. So any stresses they encounter might kill them.
If you're at 3,000 feet, that's a big choice to come down to a forest to specifically pursue food. And then their method is they then have to wait. They don't pursue it. Like a sharp-shinned hawk comes into your bird feeder and terrorizes your bird feeder, it's going to get a meal pretty quickly. a broad-winged hawk has to spend more time typically.
So that's interesting. So other hawks will swoop down and grab a mouse or whatever and swoop back up. But the broad-winged hawks don't like, they don't like fast food. they like to sit down at the restaurant and wait. You wonder why they adapted that way, because it doesn't sound like it's
well,
working
forest,
very well
they're,
for
they're
them.
They're an interior forest hawk, and mm-hmm. so that's the method they have employed. I mean, every species has a distinctive, you know, if you have two species that share the exact same characteristics, one is going to go to extinction. So that's just the method they've employed to separate themselves out from the other species in the forest.
Speaking of swooping, here's an email from Gina in Nashua. A few weeks ago, a friend was walking in a wooded part of Nashua. A hawk swooped down and stole her nylon baseball cap off her head and took it to the top of a tall pine. Gina says, is this normal hawk behavior?
No.
No.
No. Maybe there was a chipmunk on her head and she didn't realize it. That doesn't sound normal.
That's very strange. I never heard of that happening before.
There sometimes are reports during the breeding season of hawks swooping down at people's heads and attacking them if they're too close to a nest. That's particularly true of the northern goshawk, which is one of our fierce northern forest critters, but very unusual.
This time of year, it's unusual, yeah.
Okay, Gina, you stumped the bird experts, so congratulations and thank you for the email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, we've talked a lot about what we've learned in you all studying raptor migration for many years. Doing a lot of work in this field. You all know a lot, but I wonder, Julie, to you first, what don't we know about hawk migration? What mysteries remain?
Oh, lots of mysteries. There are a lot of things that we don't know about raptor populations, and that's one of the things we're trying to do at HMANA, at the Hawk Migration Association. We are in a partnership with a few other organizations to work on the raptor population index. And that is taking a lot of the long-term data sets from our hawk count database, all the citizen science observations that have gone into this migration database. We take some of these long-term data sets and we analyze them every couple of years, and then we can figure out how raptor populations are doing. It's very complicated, and if we see some declines in the Northeast at Northeast sites for red-tailed hawks, we can't make the conclusion that they must be declining, because there could be other things going on. It's just really a piece of the puzzle. We have to look at nesting studies during the breeding season, maybe information from the wintering grounds like Christmas bird count data or winter raptor survey data. But having these, having all this migration count data, and now finding a way to analyze it really is teaching us a lot about continental trends and regional trends for each species.
So it does give you a lot of information, but it also opens up other questions, it sounds like.
It does. Birds are, migration is not static. It's always changing, and birds are responding to their local weather patterns and climate, to food availability year to year. Some birds are short distance migrants, some species long, and others maybe just eruptive. They only move south on certain years if their food source up north is low.
How about you, Phil? Again, you know a ton about raptors, but what don't you know?
Well, I think Julie covered it pretty well about a lot of the challenges that we're still trying to figure out. It's the why to a lot of these questions. Why are they doing what they're doing? Why are migration patterns changing? Why is the seasonality changing? And we think we know, but the only sure way to do this is to invest in long-term research, and RPI is a great way to go. Also, some of the work New Hampshire Audubon does on breeding raptors in the state could answer some of those questions locally. So we need more of a focus on northern harriers and American kestrels, for example, two species that are declining here.
It's tantalizing, isn't it? Because you have all this information, but you don't really know.
Right.
RPI stands for Raptor Population Index, by the way, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Did you want to jump back in, Julie?
Yeah, just I was just going to say that once we have the results, we can come up with conservation assessments for different regions, for different species. Then it's our job to get this information to not just back to the Hawkwatch community and the general public, but ideally we want to get this information to conservation organizations and state agencies, and they're the ones who are going to be making conservation decisions, writing their state of the bird reports. So that is our goal, to get that information to them.
Let's take another call. This is Sue in Concord. Hi, Sue. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I was wondering two things. One is, how old is Eric the biker? And two, did he have any kind of support with him when he was biking all the way to South America? You know, another biker with him, a vehicle, anything like that?
Great question, Sue. No sag wagon, I don't think, Eric. No, you're on your own.
Yeah, I just turned 50, Sue. Hi, thanks for calling. I just turned 50, and I hadn't cycled a bike in about 20 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so you can do it, too.
Nothing like jumping in with both feet legs, I guess, in this instance. It is interesting, and I'm glad you called, Sue, because you really had a philosophy, Eric, as you approached this project, to try to do it as much like a migrating bird as possible.
Yes, and that allows me to segue into where I'm going with this. I had accepted that I was a terrestrial creature. I couldn't do it the way they do it. And I got to Georgia. I met this woman who put me in touch with this guy. His name was Nelson Lewis. And Nelson, like those T-shirts you see where you have a chimpanzee evolving through various stages to a human, this Nelson had been a hawk. He had been a birder, became a hawk watcher, became a falconer, and eventually became a hang glider. And so I talked to Nelson on the phone, and he told me that I had always assumed that if you got up there in any sort of aircraft that the birds would scatter. And he said, no, not at all. You can get wingtip to wingtip in these kettles. So I just kind of mulled that over, continued on down to Texas, and managed to get up on a hang glider in Texas, in Houston. I got up on a hang glider in a tandem flight, and then I took that with me as I traveled down through Central America. I got back to New Hampshire in March, and it just so happens that I'm an hour away from one of the best hang gliding schools in the eastern U.S., a terrific hang gliding school in Morningside in Charlestown. So I went up there and I signed up for hang gliding school, and I'm newly certified with, there's five ratings of hang gliding, 1 through 5, and I just got my second level rating, which will enable me to launch, or leave the nest, so to speak, and launch from any site around the U.S. So my plan is, I've now changed my philosophy. I think I can actually try and experience this by following these hawks more on their terms than on than being terrestrially bound to the road. And so I'm planning on redoing this trip in some way, shape, or form in a hang glider.
So that you can be more like a bird.
Well, yeah. And also, when I came back, this was originally I had set out to write a book on this phenomenon. It's just incredible. And I realized I couldn't do it. I wasn't finished. And when I was presented with this opportunity, I thought I'm going to have to grab this with both hands.
So the person who introduced you to hang gliding said that he would do it and he would be up there in the middle of a kettle, again, which is a big group of flying raptors, and they didn't mind him hanging out?
No, they didn't see him as a threat. And for me, the reason I'm intrigued by the hang gliding piece is it's not motorized. It's you, the earth, and the sun. The sun, energy in, thermal out, and you catch the thermal. And the hang gliding community, I've talked to a lot of people in the several months I've been doing this. The thermals, the statistics around what happens to a hang glider, one would assume applies to a hawk also. You know, vertical climbs, the speed that you would climb an elevator, the elevator in the Empire State Building rises at about 14 miles an hour. Thermals that develop in the U.S. that these hawks can get to get altitude can have the same sort of thermal rise, incredible rates of rise. And that's how hang gliders travel. It's exactly the same. It's the best way to look at a hang glider flying is the best way to appreciate how these broad-winged hawks are traveling.
So you could be up in the sky with the hawks for a long time. Sounds cold.
Yes. You have to dress. If you're not sweating when you take off, you're not dressed warm enough.
You know, getting back to my question, Eric, about how you approach this bicycle trip to be as much like these migrating birds as possible. From what I understand, one of the things that you tried to do was, just like a hawk, you didn't exactly know where you were going to spend the night. You didn't exactly know where your next meal was going to come from.
No.
You didn't have motels or Airbnbs lined up all the way down.
No. And that usually worked out. When I got south of the border in Mexico, it was a little bit sketchier because, well, it was south of the border in Mexico. And I would basically cycle for as long as I could and then try and find a place to camp. I brought a tent with me. If I couldn't camp safely, I'd find a motel if I could. There were a couple of interesting incidents. On December 24th, I was in a particularly dodgy part of Mexico, and I was quite nervous about finding a place to stay. And I stopped at this roadside rest stop that was selling empanadas, and there was nowhere I could stay. And I really didn't want to camp. And I asked them, could they put me up? And they showed me a shed out back, which I can only describe as a manger, and they put me up there for the night. And December 25th would have been two on the nose. It was December 24th, and I had a lot of incidents like that where I really felt like someone was looking after me.
You spent December 24th in a manger.
I did.
Okay.
I'm not joking.
What did you learn beyond all that you learned about hawks on this really impressive journey, Eric? What else did you learn besides the fundamentals of hawk migration?
Well, I cycled south from New Hampshire. I left on September 6th during the most divisive election season in my memory. And I've lived in Europe and America, and it was truly horrible. And I just was met with nothing but kindness from people of all stripes. I had one guy stop me on the road in Texas. One of the things that stood me in good stead was the perception of poverty. If you're cycling a bike, it can't be by choice. It must be by necessity. And I had a guy stop me on the road in Texas and asked me to put my bike in his truck. He was going to take me to an ATM and give me money. And I just had things like that happen to me all the time.
It's heartening to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing about your hang gliding trip following the migrating hawks. And thank you, everybody, for coming in today. Eric, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. That's Eric Masterson, Land Protection Specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education. Julie Brown, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Brown is Monitoring Site Coordinator for the Hawk Migration Association of North America. And Phil Brown, thank you also for your time.
You're welcome.
Phil Brown, Director of Land Management for New Hampshire Audubon, also Site Coordinator for the Pachmannock Raptor Migration Observatory. Again, check out our Facebook page today. There's some pictures there that our guests have contributed, our producer, and our listeners who put up some cool raptor photos too. So check it out. It's NHPR Exchange. And this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.